I'd like to thank everyone for coming this evening, especially in this wonderful weather. We're looking forward to a rather stimulating discussion on the future of Who Is Policy. We, the Internet Society that sponsored this event, we believe in making sure that the issues are addressed by way of education, essentially allowing all points of view to be presented and to give all the issues as much of a thorough airing as possible. To that end, we've invited a number of distinguished panelists to join us this evening. We have Mr. Bruce McDonald, Attorney Bruce McDonald, who's fortunate to be with us as a member of the public that actually submitted a very, very thoughtful commentary to the Who Is Task Force. And we deem it important that public comments remain a strong part of the process so that policy makers and those that evaluate the recommendations of policy recommending panels can hear what the public has to say. So we'll hear what Bruce has to tell us, and we'll find out how these comments were received by the committee to whom they were sent. Heading up that particular committee, we have Mr. Jordan Buchanan on my far right, who will be telling us in general terms about what's next for the committee, basically where do we go from here. Between these two gentlemen is Ms. Wendy Seltzer. Wendy is distinguished by serving on the ICANN At-Large Advisory Committee as our North American representative. It's her responsibility to represent the interests of the public at large, and she's here in her own capacity to speak about some of the myriad issues that affect our considerations on Who Is Policy. To my immediate left, Jeff Newman. Jeff's involved in the .us registry, other registries as well, I should add. Most significantly, the .us registry recently found itself involved in litigation with respect to anonymization services in the .us namespace, and Jeff will tell us a little bit about that. At the far end of the table, John Nevitt is the chair of the registrar's constituency within ICANN and an active member in the Who Is Policy discussions. He'll be letting us know the current state of discussions within the task force, particularly with respect to the operational point of contact proposal you'll be hearing about. Between the two gentlemen to my left is Rita Rodin, currently a sitting member of the ICANN board, and she'll be sharing her thoughts on the process. We're normally looking for each panelist to offer perhaps 5-10 minutes worth of discussion, so that by the time that we're through, we've got lots of time for questions. So I'll ask everyone to keep it short so we can keep it moving. And we're going to begin first with Bruce.
Thanks, Danny. I'm Bruce McDonald with Schneider, Harrison, Siegel & Lewis. I'm in the Washington office. We represent companies with trademarks, and I'm going to speak for closer to 5 minutes than 10 minutes, and I would simply like to advance the proposition that any change in the Who Is system, which makes information about the identity and the location of website registrants less accessible to the public, will work a real disaster on consumers. And I'm going to use as an example for how I've learned that the experience of a typical insurance and financial services company. And let me ask: does anybody know what a parked website is? If you had experience with that, a lot of people here do. Well, for anybody that doesn't, I prepared a handful of handouts, it's an example of parked websites that use the name Transamerica. And I'll pass them around, and if there end up being more people that want one than there are, which I wouldn't assume, just let me know and I'll send one to you. But I can put one on that side and on that. But if you look at attachment A there, what you'll see are parked websites using the name Transamerica for life insurance. And each of those websites is fictitious and anonymous. And by that I mean that the information available to the public about the owner of those websites is either false or anonymous, mostly false. That is to say, if you go to Whois to see who owns the website, you'll find that it's owned by a limited liability company in Tehran or Beijing, or Panama, or any number of places. And what you see here with these fictitious websites are people who are defrauding the public by using, in this case, the name Transamerica to sell life insurance. And this is extremely dangerous to consumers because they're susceptible to being taken advantage of and defrauded, and the existing Whois database is just chock full of false information. It's just flat out false. A typical example would be that the ostensible owner of the website is either an entity or an individual who doesn't exist. And the address that's listed there, if there even is such an address, it's a post office box, which is fine. There's no law that says you can't do business out of a post office box, but there are fictitious trade name statutes in each state that require a person who's doing business under a fictitious name to register that name with the state or municipal authority so that members of the public have a means to identify who it is that's selling a product or service. Under the existing Whois system, people simply register these websites using false and fictitious information. So, and what has amazed us over the last few years is the sheer number of these sites. Back, you know, ages ago, 6 years ago, when the Uniform Domain the resolution policy, the UDRP, was conceived, it might have been possible to actually get one of these back at a time, pay the filing fee at the UDRP and go prove your case. But now there are millions of these out there, millions. And the problem with any proposal such as a point of contact proposal is that it will simply give a green light. It will take away the last remaining ability of a trademark owner to help prevent the use of the trademark for consumer fraud. As it is now, even though the information that people use to register their websites is false and fraudulent, there are federal and state laws against what they do. There's a federal wire fraud statute. There's a federal statute that prohibits the use of a fictitious name for the purpose of violating those statutes. And if it's the model of your business, rather than being incidental or ancillary to your business, it's also a pattern and practice of illegal racketeering activity. So it's no surprise that a significant population within the internet domain name registration business wants to eliminate the need to identify themselves in the Whois database, because by doing so, they can exonerate themselves from liability for wire fraud and criminal use of a fictitious name. That's my basic point. Any change to the system that requires people to jump through more hoops than they already have to find out who really owns these sites will completely open up the floodgates to this kind of practice. And before I conclude, let me just throw in a remark about who are. Who are the people who are registering these fictitious websites? We've conducted innumerable private investigations, and in 9 out of 10 cases, by the use of various investigative techniques, we've observed that the party in interest is almost always the domain name registrar. And it stands to reason, if you look at attachment A, nobody would use his own name and his own address to register a website like that, because not just because it's a trademark infringement, that's just an excessively innocuous way of describing what's happening. It's counterfeiting, because it's the use of a trademark, in this case Transamerica, to advertise life insurance services, which meets the definition of counterfeiting under the 1984 Trademark Counterfeiting Act. So this is real damaging to the public, and I would simply like to urge people to realize that any change to the system that makes it harder to find out who's really doing this, it would be very damaging to the public interest. Thank you very much.
All right, and in general terms, we're going to let everyone have their initial say, and at that point, we'll open up for questions from the audience. Thank you, Bruce. Pointy, would you like to go next?
Sure. Start out by saying that I'm speaking for myself, although I serve on the unfortunate at-large advisory committee. Unfortunate because of the minute power that we have within ICANN actually to bring the interests of the individual internet user into ICANN policy debate. We try to do that. We try to explain individuals' interests in the domain name management. And individuals have a variety of interests. Some individuals are interested in finding out who's behind a domain name. Some individuals are interested in registering domain names. Some individuals are merely interested in using the internet. So here I'm speaking not for the range of individuals, and I'm not, but for myself as a civil liberties lawyer and now law professor, to talk about some of the problems with a mandatory identify yourself before registering a tool of speech regulation, which is essentially what Whois is. Whois says that in order to register a domain name, if you'd like to speak on the internet in a place that has a stable location as opposed to something that's sort of at the whim of your internet service provider or at the whim of your blogging host provider, but if you'd like to be able to speak online at a place that people can return to and that you have control of, you tend to want to register a domain name. Currently, if you register a domain name, you are told you have to put in your name, your address, your telephone number, fax number, and email address, and that all of that will be made publicly available. Individuals who want to register domain names are perhaps by their registrars given the option of a proxy service. If they pay more money, they can in some domains. As we'll hear in the .us namespace, registrants were told they couldn't even use the proxy services. But most registrants end up putting all of this information in there, often unaware that they are giving all of this information for public consumption. And to me, that triggers two separate interests that individuals have. A privacy interest, an interest in not making their home address and telephone number available to all comers, and an anonymity interest, an interest in being able to speak without having that speech tied back to your physical offline identity. And those are two separate interests which are recognized to different extents in state and national laws in the United States and in Europe. Europe more than the United States has, Europe and elsewhere in the world, of course. Europe more than the United States has strong personal data protection laws, saying that data, personally identifying information about individuals, must not be collected without their consent and must not be used for purposes beyond what they have consented to. European data privacy law frowns on demanding consent from people for widespread use of data. So merely saying, well, you got a long contract at the beginning of your domain name registration that said you consented to the publication of all of this information isn't necessarily a good way to get informed consent to share use of information necessary to provide a service. So the privacy interest is the interest in being able to express yourself online without tying that to information that would allow people to find your home, to call you, to send harassing messages, if you're a dissident, trying to reach out online to others, revealing your identity to a government that might not be so friendly toward your message. For all of these, we have to think of the range of people who are using domain names. Certainly, I won't dispute that there are the fraudsters who are trying to put up websites to trap the unwary, and maybe it's nice to have one extra way to go after them, although I would say even if they're not including any false data in Whois, there are already plenty of other laws to prosecute somebody who's misrepresenting himself online to conduct fraudulent business. Along with those people, there are many who are trying to host personal weblogs, to engage in political organization, to engage in discussion on a political or a social level, those people should be entitled to privacy in their activities. And separately, there's an interest in anonymity and being able to speak without having that speech tied to any offline identity. And that's an interest that has a long history in the United States from the Federalist Papers on down. The courts here have recognized the importance of online speech, the importance of anonymous speech, and now that we have moved to the online medium, we shouldn't abandon that. As recently as 2002, the Supreme Court said that Village of Stratton couldn't force door-to-door the Jehovah's Witnesses going door-to-door to proselytize, to identify themselves. We should sort of take those same protections for anonymity online, just to go into a couple of examples of groups who have contacted me because they wanted to register domain names anonymously and to speak anonymously. Somebody running a Walmart Sucks website wanted to express his criticism of the mega store without being identified to them or to neighbors. Another group wanted to criticize the Chicago Housing Authority and had put up posters, wanted to include a domain name where people who saw the posters could go for more information, feared that the Chicago Housing Authority wouldn't be so friendly toward their claims of discrimination or corruption, and wanted to be able to register that domain name anonymously, found that there were very few ways they could do that, whether through the Whois system or even relying on proxies, that there were few opportunities where they could get a solid guarantee of online anonymity. So I've proposed in the Whois task force to address some of these concerns about illegal activity using domain names, that we could offer the opportunity to suspend a domain name rather than revealing the information of the person behind it. So if you have a domain name that you're concerned is being used to mislead people or to infringe a trademark or to collect information or to engage in various, to coordinate botnet attacks, you could suspend the domain name, terminate all of those immediate harms, and let the person behind it preserve the due process rights to challenge having his or her identity revealed. So I'll stop there, and I'm sure there will be plenty of opportunity for further discussion and debate.
Okay, and as you have raised the topic of proxy registrations, we have somebody here that's had an interesting set of events to describe to us.
Jeff? Thanks, Danny. My name is Jeff Newman. As Danny said earlier, I am Senior Director of Law at Neustar. Neustar is the registry operator for the .us top-level domain, as well as the .biz generic top-level domain. A couple caveats. I was asked to talk about the litigation going on over proxy registrations. I'm going to try to present, although we are party to the case, I'm going to try to present it as objective as possible and try to present the facts and the findings of the court without kind of introducing my own personal views on the issue, which may or may not be different. And it's interesting I should follow Wendy because she was talking about anonymous speech, and I kind of expected when this lawsuit was first filed back in earlier this year, I kind of figured that it would get a lot more attention than it actually has because in this case, it brought straight to the center the issue of whether someone actually has the right to anonymous speech via or whether one has the right to withhold their information from the public who is in order to engage in anonymous speech. And they, at least in the Eastern District of Virginia, which is the only court that has addressed the issue, they have said no. That the U.S. government's the U.S. government's interests in protecting consumers, complying with international treaties, enforcing intellectual property, and law enforcement outweighs an individual's right to anonymous speech. So, pretty important decision. It's on appeal right now, and I'll go in a little bit more into the facts and circumstances about it in a second. But it's frankly, it's really surprised me the lack of attention that's been paid to the case because it is. Right now, it's in the U.S. Court of Appeals. I've been told that if the plaintiff loses again, that it's a case that they're going to ask for review at the Supreme Court. That said, let me go back a step, explain a little bit about the case and the facts in that case. The case concerns the registration requirements in the .us domain. The .us domain is overseen by the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, which is a part of the U.S. Department of Commerce, a part of the U.S. government. The NTIA is responsible for all policy and for managing an oversight over the .us domain. Through a public procurement, Neustar was awarded the contract in 2001, and we've been operating it since then. The contract requires that there's a publicly accessible Whois database that is accurate and up-to-date, and that is freely searchable, multi-string search. I don't want to get into all the facts because it'll take forever, so I'm just trying to go as quick as I can. As has been discussed here, there are several registrars, including GoDaddy, that offers proxy domain name registration services, which is a service that instead of putting the registrant's name in the Whois, at least in GoDaddy's case, it only put the GoDaddy incorporated a separate subsidiary, and it only puts that subsidiary's name and contact information in place of the actual registrant. Now, John Nevitt with Network Solutions, they implement proxy services in a different way, which may be a distinction in this type of case, but we'll just go off of GoDaddy because that's what this case involves. In January 2005, the Government Accountability Office was initiating a study on false contact information in the Whois database, and right around that time, the NTIA sent a letter to us or right around that time, the NTIA began investigating and noticed that there were proxy registrations going on in .us. So the NTIA sent us, Neustar, a letter basically saying that we had to stop all of the proxy domain name registration services and that we had to provide a period of time that existing registrants using proxy services would have to phase out their registrations. In other words, they'd have to either put their true information into the Whois or delete the registrations. There was a person by the name of Peterson who had a website that was registered under the anonymous services. It was pcpcity.us. On that website, he had some political commentary about different issues. And also, it's notable that he did have information, including his, he was a lawyer, is a lawyer, and had information on where he was barred, which is Illinois, and other information that one could use, and the reason I'm mentioning is because it was important in the case, that one could use to figure out who he was. In other words, he said he was a member of the Illinois Bar, and in other places it had other identifying information that made it not too difficult just by reading the content of the website to kind of figure out who he was. So he was basically told that if he didn't comply, he was told by GoDaddy, who was following instructions from the NTIA through Neustar, that if he didn't publish his information or allow his information to be published, he'd have to delete the name. So he went to court a day before the transition had to happen and filed a case in the Eastern District of Virginia, asked for a preliminary injunction to stop the policy from being put into effect. All of that kind of leads up to, there was a hearing in February of 2000, earlier February this year, and the court denied the motion for preliminary injunction. It ruled, as I said, that the balance of harms would actually, it would hurt the government more not to go through with enforcing the ban against proxies than it would revealing this person's public information. And it was noted at the time that, you know, this person wasn't really being harmed anyway because one could figure out by reading the content of what he had on his website who he actually was. The plaintiff argued, well, even if you could tell who I am, I'm bringing this case on behalf of other people. Shortly after that case was, the preliminary injunction was denied, the name was deleted. He chose to delete the domain name, but continue with bringing this case. Court issued a final ruling in the case without actually going to a trial. Normally, there's a preliminary injunction hearing. If there's an injunction that's denied, or even if it's granted, it would go on to the next stage, which is would be a full-blown trial, discovery, and a trial. But in this case, the court on its own issued a final judgment against the plaintiff, stating that the plaintiff didn't have what's called standing to bring the case, which means that even if whatever the plaintiff was saying was a meritorious legal argument, that this wasn't the appropriate plaintiff in the case because of the fact that his information was easily discernible from the website, and the court basically said that since anyone could tell who you are, you really don't have an interest in anonymous speech, so therefore you can't bring the case. That case is now on appeal. Briefs were filed. In fact, there's been at least one amicus brief that's been filed by EPIC. The case is set for oral argument on November 28th in Richmond, which is where the Fourth Circuit is located. Just to go into like a minute more of what the court said, the government argued that, like I said, that its interest was to, it entered into international treaties in which part of these treaties with other countries agreed that they would have accurate, up-to-date information and that they would require that of their CCTLDs, their country code top-level domains, and that for a court to rule against the U.S. government in this would go against those treaties and that would hurt the credibility of the U.S. government. And of course, all the arguments we heard earlier about protecting consumers and intellectual property outweighed, and law enforcement outweighed anonymous speech. There was also a argument that was brought up that basically said the plaintiff alleged that this ban on proxies was a violation of what's called the Administrative Procedures Act. The plaintiffs had argued that's a regulatory act. I'm trying to make it as simple for non-lawyers, but basically it's an act that if something is subject to the Administrative Procedure Act, the government would have to do a notice and comment period, hear from the public before it could actually implement a new rule. And the court said the APA doesn't apply because of a legal doctrine that says that if the government enters into contracts, if it's not regulated by policy but regulated by a contract, then the Administrative Procedures Act doesn't apply. So again, that's without making any, I hope that was without making any kind of more judgment in it. Neustar is a party to this case, but only because of the fact that we're kind of necessary if the court were to award the injunction or the court were to make any kind of award, it would have to be Neustar that would implement it. So we're in the case, but really it's the government, again, it's the plaintiff, Peterson, against the government. So that's a little bit about the case.
That did it well. I'd like to ask John to speak next. John's going to share with us what the current WHOIS task force, which is looking at the policy considerations, basically, what are they doing at the moment? Where are they at in the scheme of things? For some of you that have followed this policy area generally, it's safe to say that we've been debating WHOIS policy since day one. Myself, I was in the WHOIS committee back in 2001 looking at some of these same issues, so we're all kind of anxious to see this process come to a close. And I'm hoping that John can enlighten us as to where the task force is at the moment and fill in the gap somewhat.
Actually, thanks, Danny. I'm going to leave that to Jordan.
Oh,
as
all right.
Chair of the task force, I think he's the most appropriate person to explain where the task force is and where it's going. I could talk about the proposal that the task force is entertaining now because it was brought forth by the registrar community. Again, my name is John Nevitt. I work at Network Solutions as Vice President of Policy and Government Affairs, and I'm chair of the Registrar's Constituency for ICANN. So just to follow up on a couple things that what folks have said, yes, the registrars have two different flavors of what we'll call privacy or proxy services. There's the GoDaddy model, where actually the GoDaddy subsidiary becomes the registrant through a contract with the underlying registrant. The other service is the one we provide at Network Solutions, where we call it a privacy service. We are not a proxy service. We do not stand in the place of the registrant. And in WHOIS, the actual registrant is listed as the registered name holder. What we do is provide a forwarding service for addresses. We provide an email address for the registrant that automatically forwards any email to that registrant's actual email address. So it's a forwarding service more than a proxy service. It does not provide anonymization because the underlying registrant's name is actually in WHOIS, but it does provide privacy and provides protection against harassment, phishing, hijacking, slamming, that kind of thing. Obviously, there are good uses for WHOIS and bad uses for WHOIS. The WHOIS database is used by wrongdoers, and it helps enable them to do their bad works. Essentially, if you're, you know, Bruce talked about infringements, there's spamming, there's slamming, there's hijacking, there's phishing. All those are enabled, or at least assisted, by the WHOIS database. And obviously, there are good uses of WHOIS in that the intellectual property lawyers that are going after these infringers and law enforcement that are going after these bad actors, both civil and criminally, use WHOIS database on a regular basis. So what we as a registrar community tried to look at, we know our customers, and we know that our customers were really clamoring for privacy. Folks who want to use their domain names and their websites for legitimate purposes, but they don't want their personal email address and their personal home address listed publicly, they were looking for a service. Obviously, law enforcement and Bruce framed the issue very well. Law enforcement IP lawyers are looking for as much access as possible to get after the bad actors. So what we tried to do is get together and try to reach a compromise, find some middle ground, where we're providing more privacy for those who legitimately want privacy, and still have access for folks that need access, be it law enforcement or IP folks or companies trying to protect their intellectual property. So what we came out with is a compromise called OPOC, or the Operational Point of Contact. Essentially, what we would do is you take the current WHOIS and you leave the registrant name information up there, just like Network Solutions does with our current privacy product. You add the country and state of the registrant, but you do not list the personal email address, the personal mailing address, so it protects it from certain levels of privacy and protects those registrants. And then you combine the current, what's called technical and administrative contacts, into one operational point of contact. And again, that'll help address the privacy concerns of registrants that are looking for more privacy. The other aspect of the OPOC proposal is that it helps improve accuracy of the WHOIS database. Many folks saw this GAO report that showed that there's a certain level of inaccuracy. It was much less than many people thought based on the sampling, but it was still, there are inaccuracies in WHOIS, and there's no way around that. But it helps improve accuracy because the registrar community voluntarily agreed as part of this proposal to take action against patently false and inaccurate WHOIS data. Currently, the rules require registrars, upon complaint, to contact the registrant and say, essentially, there's been a complaint about inaccurate WHOIS data, and if it's not accurate, we have to warn you that your domain name is subject to cancellation or being frozen. And that's all registrars have to do. They don't have to take the next step. That if the information is not corrected, they don't have to take the next step under our current rules to actually freeze the name or delete the name. And as part of this proposal, the registrars, in order to reach a compromise between both the IP folks and law enforcement folks and the privacy folks, we're kicking something in too, and we're saying, all right, we will take that extra step. We will be bound by a new requirement to take the step of if we get a complaint of inaccurate data, we will investigate it, and if the inaccuracy is not corrected, we will take action against that registrant. And that's a big step because it's not inexpensive for us to do this. And obviously, the cost of domain names until the .com agreement goes through is going down, and margins are razor thin. You have 848 registrars competing for the same names. So essentially, you know, just based on pure economics, prices go down to costs or you lose market share. So domain name prices are very low. And it's very expensive to do this, but we're willing to do that to reach that compromise between the two groups. Obviously, there's an economic benefit for us too if we're used as an OPOC, or if our privacy service, for example, is catches on with the community, and we think it's a good service. So there is some economic benefit to us, and that's where we are in OPOC, and I'll leave it to Jordan to talk about where the task force is. The one other point I wanted to raise is for those folks who saw the new JPA or the new MOU between the U.S. government and ICANN, WHOIS was talked about in that document, and it's questionable whether a new WHOIS policy is even possible under the terms of that agreement. And I think we should throw that out because from my perspective, that's the 8,000-pound gorilla sitting in the room, because a lot of people working very hard, on the task force. And the question is, this task force, as with a couple of the other task forces, are we wasting people's times? Are people just spinning their wheels for something that may not be able to happen? And I'll just read the quote in the agreement. It says, ICANN shall continue to enforce existing policy relating to WHOIS. Such existing policy requires that ICANN implement measures to maintain timely, unrestricted, and public access to accurate and complete WHOIS information, including registrant, technical, billing, and administrative contact information. So the question is, can we even change WHOIS policy in the next 3 years while this JPA or joint project agreement is in effect or not. And you know, I think it's purposefully vague. And Paul Toomey has sent out an instruction that from the ICANN perspective, we can change who is policy. Conversations with the Department of Commerce don't necessarily jive with that. So it's an interesting issue, and I think that something that we could address at some point.
And now that we've cued Jordan.
Thank you, John. Sure.
So I noticed earlier I'm the only non-lawyer sitting up here.
No, that's another one.
Speaking today. I'm going to be speaking, I guess, my perspective as the task force chair. This isn't an official, I'm not speaking in any official capacity, and I'm certainly not speaking on behalf of my employer, although I seem to be endorsing them somehow. I want to maybe just pick up to bridge some of the gap between Danny's earlier comments and to get to where John left me off. But who is work has been going on in ICANN for a long period of time. There's been several iterations of who is task forces, and I've been involved in the current last two iterations for longer than I can remember or acknowledge, I guess. But we currently have a Who Is Task Force within ICANN, specifically within the GNSO, which I guess is the Global Name Supporting Organization. And we were chartered in order to take a look at five specific areas. The first was to take a look at what is the purpose of Who Is? Why do we have it? What is it for, essentially? Secondly, to look at the purpose of the individual contact points that are listed within Who Is. So, okay, we understand what Who Is for. What does it mean? You know, what is an administrative contact? What is a technical contact? Why are they there? And what's the function of those contacts supposed to be? The third item that we were supposed to look at was the how we should make data access, how people on the internet should be able to access that information. So once we understand what the administrative and technical contact and the registrant are for, and what Who Is is for, how do we allow people to interact with that data? And if we change that data, and for example, if we were to reduce the amount of data that was available there, are there alternative ways to get at it? Fourth, we were chartered to look at how to improve the accuracy, specifically of that information. Specifically, we were chartered to look at if there's a complaint, how can we make our response to that complaint better? So if someone complains that information is inaccurate, for example, if Mr. McDonald's looking through some records and he sees, oh, this looks like obviously false information, he can complain to the registrar. We need an efficient response to that to make sure that the data can be corrected and become accurate. And the last area that we were trying to look at actually is a carryover from some previous work that we were doing, which is how do we resolve, sometimes there's a tension between ICANN rules and national laws, and how, specifically with regards to Who Is, and sometimes privacy is the one example that was brought up. But if there's a conflict between those two things, what do we do in those situations? So we've actually completed our work on, oddly enough, on the first of those tasks and the last of those tasks. Because the last task was actually mostly done by the time we started. So with regards to the first task, actually in the handouts today, it actually contains some information about what we did. But we actually within the task force ended up proposing two different formulations that had roughly equal support for what the purpose of Who Is actually is. And the GNSO Council had a vote later that essentially decided for the rest of our work, we should operate using a particular definition. And that definition you can find in here. But it's a fairly limited definition. It basically says that the purpose of Who is to allow you to contact someone for a particular contact someone responsible for a particular domain name in order to resolve or pass on information to help you resolve problems relating to, and I'll quote here, the configuration of the records associated with the domain name within a DNS name server. Now, some people interpret that somewhat more broadly. Some people say that's a very narrow, particular technical function that that's all about. We've had some discussion about that within our task force as well, but that's the general framework that we're operating under in addressing the remaining items 2, 3, and 4 in our work. So the current state of our work is that we've been operating for a while using the OPOC proposal that John just talked about as the basis, as at least the framework for a lot of our discussions. And so a lot of what we've been doing is trying to refine that, change a little bit here in order to make it work better or more appealing to some of the various constituencies that work within ICANN. I will mention that in addition, that there's one thing I think that there's two elements of the OPOC proposal that that John didn't actually mention. One is that sometimes today there's this notion of thick registries and thin registries. So if you look up the records for .com, for example, you'll see if you go to the registry, which is VeriSign, they have a very limited set of information. They basically say, here's the name of the registrar, and here's some DNS servers, and here's some dates that, you know, when it was registered and stuff like that. If you go to what's called a thick registry, and you go to the registry, it will actually have a full set of contact information. So if you go to .org or .info and do a whois query to the registry, so in that case it would be Filius or PIR, then in those cases you'd actually get back the contact information for the registrant and the admin contact and the technical contact and so on. But that information would also exist and be provided by the registrar as well. And so that's a distinction that has largely happened sort of accidentally, I think, as opposed to anyone really planning for that to take place. So one of the things that the OPOC proposal says is that the registry should only provide the same limited set of data that you get from CommonNet today, and the registrars will provide the actual sort of authoritative contact information. And the second change is, in addition to agreeing to essentially take an action when there's a complaint about accuracy, registrars have also agreed, or the OPOC proposal proposes, that the registrars would also check the data when it comes back and make sure that it actually looks like it's right. So they can take reasonable steps to see that it's accurate. And in the case of the email address, they actually have to send an email to the address and get a response back so that you know that the email address that's listed is actually working, it's functional, and belongs to the registrant. So those are two subtleties. And the second change actually means that for any given record in the whois, you should have a pretty good certainty that you can at least email someone at the other end and be able to get in touch with them fairly reliably. And when we think about the problem space that we're coping with, really what we're trying to do is whois, as John points out, has a really important function, which is sometimes it's important to be able to contact the people responsible for a domain name. Some people think it's important to be able to contact them just for a pretty limited set of technical purposes. Some people think that it has a broader function than that. And, you know, we might want to be able to contact someone for intellectual property reasons or law enforcement reasons or various other topics as well. But regardless, it is at times important to be able to contact people associated with the domain name. But at the same time, there's privacy interests, as Wendy's pointed out. And so within the task force, we're trying to balance the notion that we want to be able to contact people with, at the same time, we don't want to necessarily expose, in some cases, you know, people's home addresses and things like that to protect some privacy. So that's the balancing act that the task force has been taking on. So a couple final notes about sort of where we're going. Recently, the intellectual property constituencies proposed another proposal called the Special Circumstances Proposal, and I'll try to summarize that very briefly. And basically, it says that if an individual or an entity believes that they have special circumstances that apply to them that make publishing their information in the whois dangerous, essentially. So if they have a safety concern, then they can request at the time that they make the registration, or I suppose later on, I don't know, okay, or later on, that they could essentially request, oh, I don't want my information to be published in the whois anymore. It's kind of dangerous, and you know, someone might, it's a battered woman shelter or something like that, and they don't want the abusive spouses to show up at the door of the battered woman shelter, so it's dangerous to actually have the information published out there. In those cases, they can apply to have the WHOIS information removed, that request would be evaluated by a third party. And if it was true that they had this sort of dangerous situation, then the information would be removed from the WHOIS. And that proposal also says that in other cases, essentially, you should always have your information in the WHOIS. So services like the GoDaddy service and I don't actually know exactly how it would relate to the service that Network Solutions runs. Those services wouldn't be allowed anymore. So unless you fall into these special circumstances, you wouldn't be able to mask out your information in WHOIS. So we're currently considering those two proposals. We're getting very near the end of the sort of base part of our work, and we're hoping during this month, November, we're actually hoping to put together a preliminary report that we'll publish and that will be sent out for public comment, essentially. So, and we certainly encourage everyone to come along, comment on it, read the report, comment on it, give us your opinions about which of those two approaches might be best. We're also considering some hybrid approaches that combine the two or make a little tweak one or the other. I don't know whether or not those will actually get published in the report or not.
Jordan, roughly timeline, when are you expecting the public comment period to begin?
So I'm expecting the public comment to begin later this month, sometime between November 15th and November 30th. And I'm expecting that it will run for about 2 months, so until about the middle of January. And so usually ICANN only has these silly little 20-day public comment periods that are very difficult for people to actually notice and respond to. We're hoping to have a somewhat longer public comment period so people can react to that. After the public comment period's over, then we go back, we read the comments, we're going to have to create essentially one position that the task force endorses. We may also have a minority report to go along with that if there are constituencies within the task force that don't agree with it. And we'll send that to the GNSO Council. If the council then endorses the policy recommendation on a two-thirds vote, and if the board of ICANN then adopts that policy, then it becomes what's called a consensus policy, and that WHOIS policy would magically percolate down through all the registry and registrar contracts and become sort of the law of the land within domain names, at least.
Jordan, if you don't mind, I've just got one follow-up question that occurred as a result of John's comments and your comments. The proposals that you're discussing essentially deal with data that will be published, and then there will also be some non-published data that will be retained by the registrar that is servicing the account, correct?
Correct. Yes.
Has the task force looked at third-party access to this non-published data and determined a policy appropriate to that?
Yeah, so we just started discussing that. It's one of the final policy topics that we're trying to resolve before we move to publishing our preliminary report. And there's a couple different notions out there. I'll say there's essentially three of them. One is that essentially today there's a status quo way to get that information. You can go to the registrar and say, hey, there's some like for example in these proxy registration cases, you can go to the registrar and say, hey, this guy's doing bad stuff and I don't like it and I'd really like to get in touch with him to tell him to stop. And the registrar might agree that they are in fact doing bad things and they'll give you the contact information and let you do that. And so the registrars are essentially proposing that system works reasonably well and we should continue doing that. The second approach I actually proposed it's actually kind of complicated and I don't know how well I'm going to be able to quickly summarize it here, but essentially says, under certain circumstances, if the domain's being used for a bad purpose or a purpose that's inconsistent with the reason why the information was hidden in the first place, then you can go and request the information be shown in that particular case. And similar to the special circumstances proposal, then there would be some third party that would figure out whether or not it was actually being used for this bad purpose, and then the information would be turned over in that case. And the third alternative actually comes out of a slightly different proposal, but it probably is worth mentioning here, which is that essentially there would be a tier of access that would be available to people that were willing to enter into contracts saying they wouldn't use the information for bad purposes. And if you entered into this contract, you'd get like a password or something like that, and then you'd be able to go get this hidden information.
Right. Appreciate that. I think logically we would want to ask as members of the public if a process is being created to potentially handle some of these queries. Will there be a cost associated with this, and who bears the cost of it? A UDRP currently, for example, costs $1,500 in filing fees plus attorney's costs. What are we looking at moving into this new set of circumstances?
Right, so the proposals so far, all of the proposals that involve costs so far operate under the premise that they will be funded out of ICANN's existing recurring revenue stream. Specifically, ICANN should tap into some of the... ICANN gets fees from registrars and registries on a per domain name basis, and the notion is that ICANN should use some of the money that they get for that in order to fund some of these mechanisms. There's some discussion in the task force about potential alternative funding mechanisms, but I haven't seen any of them yet.
All right, thank you, Jordan. Yep. All right, we'll pass the microphone now. Oops, sorry about that.
Thank you. Hi, everyone. So I'm just sweep up, I guess, the last person here, as I suppose, until the new board member gets seated in Sao Paulo, I'm the rookie board member. I'm on the ICANN board. So I come to this having some experience in the community. I see some of my familiar faces here. As a lawyer working in some of the internet space in the early days with ICANN, I do appreciate that the Who Is discussion has been going on for quite a while. And I just want to, I guess, do my disclaimer at the beginning of my remarks that I'm not speaking on behalf of the board in any formal way. I'm not representing the board in any position held by the board, nor am I representing the position of my law firm. But it's interesting to hear others comment on how long this process has been going on. I think that it is very much on the ICANN board's mind trying to get some sort of consensus in the community and get a proposal to the board that reflects community input in a meaningful way. But this process has been dragging out for a while. And I think my own personal view is that it's because there are people like Bruce and Wendy who are very, very articulate. And I'll pick on those two because they were sort of a more objective. We have some task force and constituency members here. But they kind of objectively, I think, very succinctly summarized the two principles at odds here. The right to privacy, and dovetailing that with the potential for abuse. I think that nobody in the room would argue with the fact that, you know, there are privacy rights that people want in the United States. In Europe, they're codified much more than in the US. It's sort of a state law privacy regime. But people have a right to privacy, and nobody wants to see a battered women's shelter have some husband, you know, come and try to abuse a woman based on finding an address and who is. Conversely, no one wants to see, you know, damage to intellectual property owners, small or large companies, who've worked to build a brand and have a lot of money at stake and allow abuses to occur on the internet. So I think it's important to reach a balance. And I am personally excited to hear what the task force has been doing and that there's going to be a chance to have some public comment in a meaningful way and get a proposal up to the board. I guess the other thing I would say is that having worked on the DRP and the policy development process that's used by ICANN, I guess I was the fortunate or unfortunate person who had, I'll call it, control of the pen, who was charged with actually writing words down that would try to characterize concerns of both intellectual property constituencies and the non-commercial constituencies. And I had a lot of fun working with those constituencies in a somewhat short period of time trying to compromise. But I think that was something that John was saying, that this operational point of contact proposal tries to do is compromise. And I'm heartened because I feel as though these issues have been around for a while and people are looking, they do understand each other's concerns and they're looking to compromise. So as a new member of the ICANN board, I'm excited to see the results of that compromise. And I hope that it will take into account, you know, both parties' concerns and try to come up with a workable solution.
Now, Rita, John did raise the question with respect to the language in the joint project agreement, and I'm sure that you and other board members have thought about it. When I read it for the first time, I was amazed that billing language was in there because I don't recall that as actually being part of the current Who Is policy. Maybe you care to share your thoughts as to what actually is enforcement of current policy. Does that mean that there's not going to be proxy services? Does it mean that you're going to support proxy services? What does it mean?
Well, I think it's a great question, and I'm looking at my fellow board member here because I know that there was quite a lively discussion about why we are referencing who is in this JPA. There's a lot of other things and issues out there that are not specifically referenced here. And I can only tell you what we were told, which is that the words, and I'm looking over here at John's paper, the existing policy, what we were told was that, yes, as a condition, given the U.S. government has made statements about who is, there was a condition that the current policy will be enforced until such time as there is some sort of a consensus policy that comes up through the ICAM process and is in fact adopted by the board. But I think it's a great question, and it sort of, to me, emphasizes a little bit of the problems as well, that, you know, now we have this statement in here, and so people are going to be worried about why is this here, what does this mean, and it's going to kind of cause people to get off the track, if you will. You know, I looked at these formulations of, you know, the purpose of who is, and one is extremely limiting, in my view, and I think it doesn't reflect legitimate concerns by intellectual property owners. And the second one seems more general, and I think it makes people feel as though ICANN is going to engage in mission creep, and it's beyond its technical oversight. And while I find that scintillating on an intellectual level, I don't think it's helpful to have people sort of go off on that tangent when we have, you know, a real issue here, which is what are we doing with the WHOIS database. So I hope that there's not going to be a lot of sort of tangential things that sort of come to the fore here. I really think that this notion of an operational point of contact can intellectual property owners and others in the constituencies look at that, try to compromise with that or any other proposal and come up with a real sort of hearty recommendation that at least people are going to support. You know, and unfortunately, lawyers get a lot of flack, and I know probably many of you don't like lawyers. But what we have the difficult, yet I think sometimes enjoyably fun and challenging task of doing is coming up with compromises. Right, and so every day when you're doing a deal with two parties, right, big or small, each party has a position, and sometimes they're directly at odds, and you have people that refuse to get off that position. And so what you have to do is foster communication, make sure they really understand what the other party's position is. You might not think they're reasonable, but it's important to try to come together, I think, and come up with some sort of compromise, and I'm hopeful that's what can happen here.
Thank you.